OpenStake, welcome. Thank you for taking the time today.
It's my pleasure to be here. You invited a guy in a mask on your new podcast. Congratulations, by the way.
Appreciate that. Yeah, you are the first to have that distinction, which is great. I've had one NIM, I think, Marks, who's the founder, co-founder and CEO of Open Secret, which, you know, kind of keeps us on topic. But you're my first NIM, so, and for good reason. And in fact, you know, the reason I reached out and wanted to have a conversation is that you are in an incredibly interesting, rare position in, I believe, from some great conversations you've had with Stefan Lavera, with Marty Bent and others, and your thread on Nostr, which I'll post a link to. You're in an interesting position to strike a balance between burn it all down on the one side and comply harder, you know, on the other. And so I think that's the gist of the conversation I'd like to have with you, is to find what middle point or what middle path is there, if there is one, and to get into certainly your experiences, your insights, and what, if anything, we can do to balance out the what to me is an incredibly off-kilter imbalance of power and trust. And so let's start here. You are a NIM for good reason, and therefore, you know, it's not as if I'm going to point people to your LinkedIn or your Facebook profile. You've done it before. I'll ask you to do it again here. Give us an introduction, OpenState, on your background, where you are and how you got there, and what your work looks like, to the degree that you can share that.
All right. Well, I used to be a corporate banker, and I used to manage accounts for fairly large businesses that had over $1 million or more of corporate lending. And so I used to assess risk. And at one point, I just got disillusioned with the whole exercise. I realized that the entire system, the entire financial system, was really meant and rigged, and it was meant to enrich kind of a very select class of individuals. And this is done through incentives, it's done through messaging, it's done in a number of different ways, but I saw it and I implemented it. So here I was doing fairly large loans. I was being told that I was helping businesses who needed to have a new warehouse, a new piece of equipment. But really, I saw through that at some point. I was just facilitating a monetary system that was bloated and really incentivized to really help the corrupt make more money. When a bank doesn't have the money it lends out, is that system really fair? Because the borrower needs to pay interest. I saw the huge bonuses. You know, I got huge bonuses. It was great, but I couldn't sleep at night. So wanting to make a difference, I looked for roles. I looked for jobs, kind of at a point where I wanted to make a difference. And I saw a few roles being advertised within my government. So I said, well, you know what? There's no way I'm going to get this. I'm just going to apply. I applied, and it just so happened they needed somebody with banking experience. So they took me on as a policy and legislation advisor, which is what I do currently. I've been doing it for a number of years. And my initial role was to really help create and draft legislation and policy that would help the local industry in my jurisdiction. I work in a jurisdiction with a very large financial services sector. And so I saw that as a plus. I said, well, this is my opportunity to really help and really do something that means that will affect change around me. I said, let's do it. So I joined the government, and literally the first day or two after I joined, they asked me, well, do you know what the SNTF is? And so I had no idea at the time. I really didn't know. But I had to hit the ground running. Because my focus changed from banking to implementing anti-money laundering standards, which is what you, I think you're based in the U.S., that's the Bank
Correct.
Secrecy Act.
Right.
Among a number of other anti-money laundering kind of pieces of legislation. So my role shifted very, very quickly. And then I actually helped draft about 12 different pieces of legislation that implemented these anti-money laundering global standards in my country. So as a bit of background, I mean, I'd be repeating myself if I just went through all this again, but my focus of the other talks that I give is really about the subjugation of sovereignty by global standard-setting bodies. So I heard you speak about the BSA in one or two of your previous podcasts.
You
U.S. won't be able to remove or abolish the BSA until it settles its position in those global standard-setting bodies. The SATF, the Financial Action Task Force, is the global standard-setting body that sets all of the requirements that countries are, for all intents and purposes, obligated to implement when it comes to KYC, when it comes to limits, suspicious activity reporting, or recording and detention and maintenance of beneficial ownership information, sanctions, all of those things fall within this umbrella and are to some extent dictated by the Financial Action Task Force. So the Financial Action Task Force is really a global forum where unelected bureaucrats like me of various different countries meet and discuss, well, what should we do? What do we see as a wrong? What can we do to fix it? And even though elected officials have the ultimate say, they are not experts. So your elected representative, they trust the unelected bureaucrats like me who go to those forums, who have those important discussions, and come back and saying, well, here's what we need to do. And they have a list of 5, 10, 20, 30, 50 different things that have to be implemented. And the SATF works by a system of mutual evaluation reports where countries mutually evaluate themselves. You might be interested to know that the U.S. is due for its evaluation next year. So
what would that look like? What would that, in practice, open up the United States to or require the United States financial regulatory bodies to conduct or do?
So there is a distinction between anti-money laundering and regulation. A lot of people can confound the two.
Certainly.
However, anti-money laundering is seen more as a criminal offense than a regulatory type of requirement. And so if you're engaged in, you know, financing terrorism or you're laundering the proceeds of crime. And here the word crime, by the way, is increasingly nebulous, where even just speaking out on social media is now perceived as a crime. So as the term is made more nebulous, its implementation will also expand and be prone to an assessment and ambiguity. And so the SATF would meet, they set the standards. They say, well, here's what we see types of criminal activities happening. Here's what the criminals are doing. What can we do to stop it? And that's basically what they say happens at those meetings. This is the formal side of things. And then they meet and they'll argue for hours and hours and days on a particular word, a particular requirement that has to be put in. And then it's added to the standards. And then a country like the United States has to implement it. During the implementation phase, which is typically 2-3 years, a country can have some leeway as to how it implements it. However, if it deviates in any way in its implementation, it'll have to justify why it deviated. So if it used a specific term that isn't in the standard, then assessors will come to the country and look at all the laws, how they're applied, and say, well, look, you're using this term, it's different. And then the country will have to explain, well, we chose this because of that. And really the point is to be assessed under a microscope to make sure that you're implementing the standards exactly to the letter. There's 40 standards.
Pause there for a moment. Sorry, but state. So one thing I'm curious about, and I think it's important, certainly I'm curious about, is given, as you said rightly, that this is an unelected group of bureaucrats, when you say have to, what are the carrots and sticks that FATF has to, and I'll use the United States in as much as, you know, we tend to be the most bravado. Certainly under the current administration, there is not a tendency to bend the knee to European or other entities. What are those carrots and sticks? What could FATF do if they come to the United States and Department of Treasury, I presume, has not complied in a way that they see as necessary?
Well, you're right in that the United States is at a very kind of unique position because of its role in the global financial system. But I think you're wrong about the bravado. And I think the bravado is a verbal one. Okay. Just my opinion.
Sure, please.
Trump was actually the one the United States had presidency over the Financial Action Task Force when Trump was in office, and that's when they implemented KYC requirements for Bitcoin and digital assets. Now, what happens if a country decides not to follow these requirements? Essentially, they get a negative rating. So the ratings follow a largely compliant, compliant, non-compliant, or partially compliant kind of rating system. If you get a non-compliant or partially compliant, which are the two negative ratings, you will be assessed as a higher risk jurisdiction for anti-money laundering, depending on which requirement it is. So, for example, if it's about the transparency of your legal entities in your jurisdiction, if you get a partially compliant on that, it means your legal entities are very opaque, which is a very high risk and could be very useful for criminals if they want to launder money. So that would be a serious negative rating. When your country receives a negative rating, typically the FATF gives you a period to redress or gives you the option to say, well, do you want to fix this? While you're fixing it, you're put on a gray list. It's a period of observation. It's called a gray list. That's just a common term. You have time then to fix the situation. You'll be reassessed after that. And if you still don't do it properly, then the Global Financial Centers and the TradFi, the traditional financial system in the world, then that kicks in. When you look at Moody's, when you look at a country's rating for debt, when you look at correspondent and respondent banking relationships, all of those are based on largely on the FATF's rating system. So for the US, being in its own kind of class may not have that big of an impact, because most worldwide jurisdictions have a correspondent relationship with the US. And so really, if the US doesn't follow it, we're still going to maintain those relationships.
Right. But if you're the Maldives.
However, it is the US which has been the driving force behind the FATF.
Why do you know that to be the case?
Well, I don't know that to be the case. I only know what I see, right? And currently, the US and Europe are the two largest drivers behind the FATF's work.
And let me rephrase, and that was not to challenge your knowledge. Happy to do that if that comes to it. But what I mean by that is, what is in it for the United States? What do you believe to be the incentives or the motivations behind taking the pole position, as it were, with FATF?
There's a large number of benefits for a country to have this kind of a framework in place. One is the ability to ring fence or put some kind of limits on global financial transfers. Also, it gives you...
So what you're saying is tax revenue.
Well, yes. Yeah, yeah. I was going to get there.
Yeah, please go ahead.
Having perfect information, you know, we've talked about CBDCs as a community. I think people know what that is by now. We know the dangers of that. Well, essentially, if you use the traditional financial network through the main banks, if you use your bank account, you're already using something akin to a CBDC, where the government has perfect information, is able to freeze your money without
travel
the process.
Rules.
The travel rule is something that's being implemented and still being implemented. It's problematic, but that was actually put in place while the FATF was under the United States presidency.
And this is good to know.
Right. So the US has been a driving force behind these KYC global standards. And I think the number one reason is control and information. What the point of that control, what the ultimate goal of that might be, that's subject of speculation. But having perfect information on financial flows, I think, is the number one reason. And being able to control them and to bypass due process. So the FATF and, sorry, the financial system KYC requirements are really a foot in the door to erode due process and erode our rights. Searching without a warrant used to be illegal. Now it's perfectly acceptable for the United States to do it. For the government to ask a bank for all of your transactions, or to be able
to freeze. Judicial extra legal, a toolkit.
So all of that is actually possible today because of the FATF and the requirements that it requires countries to implement. For a different country, and I'm talking outside the United States, not following the FATF's requirements has immense consequences because of their relationship to the United States. The United States is essentially the main stick behind the FATF. Most banks, if you're in Uzbekistan, you're in Uruguay, you want to have a correspondent relationship with a U.S. financial institution.
Could you quickly, my background, I do appreciate and understand what a correspondent bank is and does. Could you give us a quick primer on that and as to then why that is so important?
The United States was a global trade currency. And take Uruguay, for example. If a certain industry wants to buy equipment or sell their product, it's not going to be done in the local currency. It's going to be done in the U.S. dollar. So those businesses, those people need U.S. dollars in order to trade internationally. And the only way to obtain U.S. dollars is through a kind of clearing relationship with the U.S. banks, like J.P. Morgan, etc. So a local Uruguayan bank will have a relationship with J.P. Morgan, which will then allow the bank in Uruguay to obtain U.S. dollars. And once the Uruguayan bank has them, they're able to give them out to the local enterprises so they can trade, etc. So that is the implementation of the stick. And it's basically the United States that enforces this through their traditional banking network.
If we back up a bit, and I am curious about this. So coming from, it sounds like commercial banking prior to your role in your government, how did you not know what you were walking into? I mean, is it possible to operate in a bank and not already be buried in compliance requirements, including FATF and other? So where was sort of the disconnect between your role in commercial banking and then stepping in, you know, to the hornet's nest, in my view, in terms of the need now to be part of implementing these standards and these regulatory regimes?
You can't see me smiling right now. Are you saying I had bad judgment? Is that it?
No, well, one might charitably assume that you know, there was maybe some hopeful naivete, but you tell me.
Right. I'll let you know what I saw from the banking side. If a new business wanted to have a relationship with us, we needed to know who their owners were, who the directors were. We need to have KYC on all those people. We as a bank had perfect information on the accounts, the usage, the balances, the type of financial activity going on. We'd see through their financials, where they are, where they stand, etc. So a bank is used to receiving all the information it wants, especially if there's a lending relationship. So for me, that's what I saw, and I saw the justification for it. Now, going to government, that's when I realized that the government also obtains this information. And that's something I didn't know. I didn't know the extent of the anti-money laundering requirements and what happens behind the scenes. And that's really why I created this NIM, is so that I can speak out, speak freely, and just alert people that this is happening. It's getting worse. You have the CARF system, which is coming in 2020, Crypto Asset Reporting Framework. That's spearheaded by the same organization that's responsible for the FATF. You also have a global taxation framework that's being put in place for businesses. And they're also talking about a Pillar 3, which is a global taxation system for wealthy individuals. So once you kind of go behind the scene, I've sat in discussions, I've sat in with meetings with the FATF, the team that assessed my country, my jurisdiction. I was part in defending my jurisdiction so we could get good ratings. I've put in legislation. I've assessed the requirements, identified the gaps. I've essentially delivered what my mandate is supposed to be, but something basically didn't sit right within me. And that's why I created this NIM. Mm-hmm. So looking at the entire system, it was a wake-up call. It was a greater wake-up call than what I lived through when I was a commercial banker. Much more worrisome for me, what I'm seeing now, than what I saw working for a bank. So there was some optimism, maybe some naivete. However, I'm glad I actually opted to choose, because now hopefully I can do something about it.
Absolutely. And it does make sense, as you explained that in commercial lending, the required information is inbound, it's volunteered, you're not in a position where you effectively need to hover above and surveil and collect. It is willingly given to you because I'm a business that wishes to obtain a loan from you. So that makes a great deal of sense. So you are, to sort of summarize and take this forward a bit, you're a civil servant implementing local implementations or putting in place local implementations of global standards. You've touched on this. What are some of the key observations that you can share that have shaped your view on how much damage these policies do, how much trust they erode between one's government and the individual? And I'll add one thing. I think there will be a percentage of the audience, and I've had previous conversations recorded on this with other guests, who I think understandably look at KYC, they look at the Bank Secrecy Act or equivalent, and they, some would say naively, some would say, you know, in a good-natured fashion, think, well, of course, you know, just like 2% inflation in the United States, well, of course, that's the way it's done. So in speaking to those individuals who may not appreciate the gravity of these tools, these global bodies and their rules, what have you seen that is a wake-up call as to how they are a net negative, assuming you believe they are?
I'll take an angled approach to answering your question, if you don't mind.
Please.
By stating that your ancestors and the DNA that allows you to live today, that comprises who you are as a person, as a human being, that DNA comes from a long list of ancestors. You can go up back 10,000 years. Those ancestors have lived through everything. War, famine, viruses, Black Death in medieval times. One thing that is instrumental to you having the life you have lived today is your ancestors fought for due process and a respect of rights, which used to be a kind of a foundational part of the United States.
Sacrosanct.
Right. So, you know, expression, the right to property, right? Benefiting of safety, being safe and being respected and not having somebody know everything about you and not having somebody put you to jail for no reason without telling you first and allowing you the opportunity to defend yourself. We take those for granted, but they didn't just arrive. It wasn't the government that gave those to us. It was our ancestors who fought for them with their lives, quite literally. We all have ancestors that fought, at least in the Western world, or even in Eastern world. We all have ancestors who fought for something they believed in, to implement a foundation of rights in order for their children to have a better life. You look at AML and KYC today, it might be small, it might be acceptable. However, it is an erosion of those rights. And the erosion, once that crack is put in place, it's never going away. You know that you have to remove your shoes when you take an airplane. You have to go through that machine where you have to raise your hands because of the state of emergency that started in 9/11. It's being renewed every year since. That's what allows that, because you have a right to have somebody not search your bags. They need to have a warrant to do that, or they used to.
Never let a good tragedy go to waste, as they say.
So that crack is an erosion of the rights that your ancestors fought for that many people today don't really value much because they take it for granted.
Yes.
And it's only when it's lost, of course, that you realize what you had. So the ability for you to transact, the ability for you to speak your own mind, the ability for you to be able to buy things that you want, to say things that you want, to criticize the government. All of those things are based on these rights that are being eroded today. The UK has set up legislation that's criminalizing speech, Germany, even the US to some extent, Canada certainly. And so really, to the people who look at KYC and don't get angry, that's fine. I respect every single human being out there. However, there has to be some awareness of the erosion of the rights that were given to us by our ancestors who fought for them. And we have to take that gift and respect.
I very much appreciate that perspective. And I think it is very important to point that out, that it was not always this way. And it was dramatically different. I mean, there are films, novels, chronicling of history in the not so distant past, where we traveled without passports. We, you know, which would be a hot button issue, certainly in the United States these days, but that we could conduct international commerce, that God forbid you had a Swiss bank account, right? And I know my perspective, my views on these things have evolved, but I think as you're pointing out, this ultimately comes down to our ability to think, speak, act, transact freely, in so much as we are not, you know, violating the rights and property of others. And, you know,
for somebody who's new to this, I mean, you know everything about a government. You have democracy and you have transparency. But if the government knows everything about you, you have a very high probability of tyranny.
Well said.
And there's an asymmetry between how much the government knows about you and how much you know about the government. Whereas the government has been putting in place powers and legislation through the FATF and other organizations in order to have that information. The ability of citizens to know about the government is relegated to some FOI laws that were done dozens, you know, 50 plus years ago in most jurisdictions. So those FOI laws need to be revised. They need to be updated. You know, if you asked me what an ideal FOI law is to have a law that says that everything that a government, civil servant, elected representative does has to be made public. And there's a timer. So things that aren't highly critical are made public right away. So people can look at their elected representative's email and say, all right, well, what has this person been saying, etc. Everything that you send to an elected representative, you have to know that it will be made public. For things that are very sensitive, like this attack on Iran, you don't want people to know that right away. So you put a timer. And the timer has to go through checks in order to be obtained. Once it's obtained, you've proven that it's a kind of time-sensitive, critical issue that people can't know about. Then maybe it's released in 5 years. But it will be released. Absolutely nothing that government does should be kept a secret. Nothing. Ultimately, it's just a matter of time, because if you look at the JFK files, you look at whatever investigation the FBI does, ultimately, after 50 years, is it still critical, time sensitive? And the answer is yes, only if people acted wrongly, because they want to hide what they did. If people did what they did, and they followed the law, and they did so in good conscience, and there's no negative foul play involved, they won't mind if it's made public. In the end, it's just a matter of time. So those FOI laws really need to be updated. Do I think it's going to happen? I see in my ministry, in my department, I see an inherent assumption that the government has the right to know absolutely everything about its citizens.
Right.
It's not even something that's discussed. It's not even brought up as, should we? It's, well, we need to know this. Let's do it. And with that information comes immense liability, potential for misuse.
Certainly, breaches or otherwise. Absolutely, we see this every week, it seems.
Yeah,
and I think what the takeaway for me, and I hope our audience is for this, is the remark that in a true democracy, the government knows little about the people know everything about the government, and the inverse is tyranny. And I think that's the call to arms to me, is that we can observe, I think easily, readily, that we are in a panopticon. We as citizens, as individuals, are in a complete and total panopticon as classically defined, where the government fights for the minimal amount of performative transparency. So the question, I think, you know, is what have you seen that has most ignited or informed your perspective? I don't know if you care to add any particular examples. Again, I know that can be touchy, but I think you have more than adequately addressed at a macro level why the inaction or enacting of these rules and these bodies is a tremendous problem.
I mean, there's a lot of different threads that I could pull here. Let's just pull on one, say incentives. And there is one that I do want to pull. And, you know, I will use the opportunity to speak with you to kind of release something that's been near and dear to me for a while. But let's just start on incentives within government. For a civil servant like me, right? Now, some civil servants, most people are like, they're getting paid a lot of money. They have huge pensions. They have all these benefits for working within government. Yes and no. Most of the money is made when a civil servant goes back to private sector.
Sure, the revolving door.
They'll use their experience, their connections within the government to sell themselves. And that's really where they make the money. Every civil servant knows this. The career civil servants that are enrolled for 10 plus years are very dedicated to their work. And those are my colleagues. They're very dedicated. They go to the training, they're told anti-money laundering is a requirement or else criminals will misuse our banks, our real estate, they'll do crooked things. We don't want that. And so they are really dedicated to ensuring that their jurisdiction isn't used for money laundering and other things.
They feel like they're fighting a good fight, I presume.
They're fighting a good fight. And a lot of them are not getting paid that much compared to the private sector.
And certainly, so that's the default in the United States. When you open that up, I'll just say that in the U.S., I think, unless you're at the absolute top tiers, it is the backroom dealings and the second career where you make your money.
The incentive then is to build relationship with the private sectors, is to build relationship with the people you're meant to regulate, to limit. You have these big companies that come in and they want something. They'll lobby for something. As a civil servant, you're going to meet somebody up for supper at a conference. Really, what's going on behind your mind is, how can I sell myself to get that big contract from this person in front of me? And so the incentive for a civil servant, other things as well, for example, being sent to Hawaii or Paris for a conference, going to a 5-star hotel while you're at that conference, getting all your meals paid. Those things are what incentivize civil servants. And so that's wrong, if you ask me, because people will act in their own best self-interest. And in this particular case, it doesn't align with the interests of the citizens, if you ask me, in my opinion. And so that's the incentive system. If you ask me what a good incentive system should be, well, I think all civil servants should get a bonus if the GDP per capita in a jurisdiction went up. And it should be directly proportionate with that increase in the wealth of citizens.
And imagine
you could
that.
You could do this on a gross or net, you know, after inflation. Doesn't matter. That's.
But anyone, I would just say anyone who's worked in sales as I have and do, you know, that's a team bonus. And generally it's an individual bonus, but in the case of being unable to measure individual contributions, you can at least measure the contributions of the team to the goal and you get a proportionate participation in that. So once again, you know, private sector, obvious, government, it sounds like it would be quite novel.
It would be novel. And it makes complete sense for a civil servant to get a bonus if the people who are impacted by the laws that the civil servant puts in place or creates or the policies that it suggests, if the population's doing well, if the businesses are doing well, that should bring about a bonus. But there's no such incentive program in government. And so the first thing that's one of the things that I realized, the incentives are all wrong. And I saw the incentives in the banking, my banking career, right? It's all about sales. It's all about, doesn't matter what the business should have in terms of leverage, increase that loan to the maximum, right? So incentive number one. But there is something else that I've realized that really weighs heavy, and I haven't spoken about this in any of my other presentations, is I think having a government that is trustworthy requires the involvement of its citizens. And that, I find, is probably my perspective from within the government, looking back at a population that delegates political power. The only thing they'll do, other than discussing it with their neighbor or friends, is go to a voting box, take up one of the names there, and put that ballot in the box. And that's, for most people, the extent of their involvement in the political world, at least the extent of their involvement that has any impact, however little that is. And that's something that I see. Now, I've created legislation. I didn't like what I was creating, but we have to consult on it. So I sent the legislation. I did the consultation process. Nobody commented. Nobody raised their voices. They probably read it. As a lawyer, as an accountant, whatever your profession that person was, they read it. They're like, oh, I need to adjust this and this and this. My business plan needs to change for this new law.
So they took it, if I hear you, they took it as a settled matter, and I'm now going to react to it as opposed to attempt to affect or change it.
Exactly. What I really wish would have happened is for the population of my jurisdiction to look at that law and go, wait a second, what's this? And I've spoken to people on the side saying, well, you know, have a look at this consultation. I've pushed them, you know, the little that I can, I've pushed them. But they still don't speak up. And they don't speak up because of an inherent fear of speaking up, or just the belief that they don't know political things or legal things, or laziness. And I have to admit, sadly, that there is a lot of laziness.
Absolutely.
In the general population. And let's just admit it, it's easier to watch Netflix than it is to look at a consultation.
Yeah, laziness or fatigue. And so a related question, if I may, I'm thinking about my own sort of relationship to that. I think for me, certainly, I presume for a lot of my fellow Americans, there is a sense that it is screaming into the void. You know, that sure, the FCC may post on some terribly designed FCC.gov site for commentary, but, you know, it'll get lost in the void, or it is just so cumbersome, which can be written off to laziness. So the question I have, do you believe there is something particular to your jurisdiction where they are better at or more attuned to listening? Or are you perhaps advocating more broadly that we just as citizens need to take that opportunity because it is under
application of global standards? For example, the BSA. Say you want to start a campaign to abolish the BSA. I'm looking at Odell right now.
Absolutely.
But assume you want to do that. You're going to send letters. You're going to lobby. You're going to talk to representatives. Say you talk to Senator Lummis. Senator Lummis says, this is a great idea. Let's do it. And Senator Lummis is able to convince magically everybody around her, all of her other electors. A miracle. She's able to do that.
Indeed.
Now, in order to affect that change, the jurisdiction has to look at the consequence of abolishing the BSA with respect to the global standard-setting bodies and the requirements and the standards that they put in place. So now the U.S. has to say, what do we lose by doing this? Well, we lose something that we fought to implement for the last 50 years, since 1991.
Right.
Not only that, we're also harming our banks, who won't have access to all the anti-money laundering beneficial ownership information, which is a huge honeypot for banks, let's be honest.
Sure.
And we lose information on taxable activities that our citizens are doing. And even if they get through all of those and they say, we're willing to assume the risk, then the decision has to be made, well, do we remain in this global standard setting body like the FATF, or do we leave it? If they choose to remain, which I think is really, whether to remain or leave is really a decision that the U.S. has. No other country in the world has that option. Now, if they choose to leave, great. I mean, fantastic. But then there'll be severe consequences. Most jurisdictions don't have that option, so they stay.
Then,
unelected bureaucrat like me goes to an FATF plenary and then has to raise their hand. Has to raise their hand and go, well, actually, my government has this opinion now. We shouldn't be doing KYC. We shouldn't be doing this or that or that. There's 40 other countries in the FATF membership that you have to convince at that level in order to remove that requirement. So not only is it a miracle for Lummis to have convinced everybody in the U.S.
Multiply that now, by 40.
Right. All that effort times 40. Because now you have to convince a majority of these, well, 20, you have to convince a majority of those other jurisdictions to remove that requirement. So this is a centralization of policymaking and development. And that centralization essentially removes your ability to have an impact or a say on what you have to, what governs you. These global standard setting bodies, there are global standard setting bodies for all consequential policy in the world. Doesn't matter what it is. Even fruit. The OECD has a fruit standard on how banana should look.
Of course.
It's important. You don't want a banana to have less than 2.5 fingers width so that the, you know, to be able to peel it. There's global standards. Global standards for everything of consequence. So that's the process that a country has to go through if it wants to abolish the BSA. So I look at those initiatives and really the U.S. leaving the FATF, which I never believe it will do because it's the linchpin, the strongest pillar. It's the foundation of the FATF. But it has to be either all the other countries leaving or a majority of them leaving or the U.S. leave. And if the U.S. leaves, I don't even know if that will be sufficient to erode.
Yeah.
Just like the World Health Organization, the U.S. leaving, not sending funding, somebody else comes up. It's the Hydra. There's another head. And so how do we get rid of this?
That is my next question.
If I knew, I would lobby for it.
Right, but, right. Because I think, you know, as we're going through this conversation, and we have wonderfully touched on many of the questions I had made note of, you know, there are, in my mind, the perspective of, can you change it from within? And I think you're making a sound argument as to the high improbability of that, even if the U.S. was to flick that first domino. And, you know, American exceptionalism, guilty, but I might have assumed that you were going, I was hoping that you were going toward, if the U.S. went, if Senator Lummis pulled off that miracle, it's the single miracle that could bring down the Jenga, but it sounds like no. And so we're left, in my mind, this is where I'd love to spend the next bit of the conversation. What else, if anything, can be done? You are inside. Presumably you're working, you know, toward the effect that you can have, or must we necessarily exit through Bitcoin or other means? So let's sort of move into that. What can be done other than complete exit?
What can be done other than complete exit? I look at the cypherpunks and I look at the creation of Bitcoin and other technology. The internet's a big one. It's bigger than Bitcoin. The internet originally, companies lobbied to ring fence. You wanted a CompuServe or an AOL, or they lobbied and worked really, really hard to make the internet something that's very controlled.
The original walled gardens.
The walled gardens. Now, in the battle for the internet, we won in terms of being able to access information. Now you have internet service providers all over the world, but there's also a centralizing trend with internet service providers now. Taking, as an example, Starlink. Starlink is now responsible for a sizable contribution or access point to the internet, and that's a centralizing force. When Musk goes away and the next CEO comes about and says, well, I don't want to give this country or that country or this person access to the internet. So the internet now is, and we look at big companies, the internet is essentially Google and Facebook and a few countries, it's not countries, organizations, companies, and the internet is centralizing little by little. So the internet is a good example of what we could do financially. We created Bitcoin as a protocol. We're able to transact. But now we're seeing the Bitcoin sector being integrated within traditional finance. And that's being done through legislation that many people in the Bitcoin economy are lauding. They're very, very happy that
absolutely, no question.
Their JP Morgan bank can custody Bitcoin. That's amazing. They're clapping their hands. That to me is worrisome because it's the same effect as Google having more centralized power within the. And at one point, I'm not saying right away, but at one point, through legislation, through lobbying, through criminalizing certain activities, having self-custody of Bitcoin may be seen as something that could lead to money laundering and therefore should be controlled.
Had a different outcome in our last presidential election, undoubtedly we would be there or close to it. And we may still.
The last 5 years, I've seen unhosted wallets as a term coming up more and more
absolutely
within the SETF discussion. Unhosted wallets. And so the SETF functions in a very odd way. They can't dictate directly. They can't say, well, this is what you should do. They can't say that. What they'll do is they'll send questionnaires. They'll send questionnaires. And this is one that I've seen, for example. It sent a questionnaire. The questionnaire asks about the risks that we've assessed within our jurisdiction related to cryptocurrencies, virtual asset services, which is the term they use. And they'll ask a question. They'll say, we've assessed the ability to hold cryptocurrencies and unhosted wallets as high risk. How is your jurisdiction mitigating?
Presumption of guilt.
That was a verbatim question that I saw. And now my jurisdiction was put in a situation where they had not only to assume that there was a high level of risk and acknowledge it, but also think about how those risks were going to be mitigated. And that's how the SETF works.
Right. And so they seeded the idea of the unhosted wallet, which is this ridiculous misnomer to begin with. And they follow it up with, well, naturally, we know that this is unsavory. And so how are you going to solve for this problem that we just created?
So I'm going to answer your question, how we can best effect change, either from within or by exit. And I'm going back to really the two fundamental principles that are needed for a government that is, I'm not going to say trustworthy, because I never think you should trust a government, but that would make a government accountable, increasing the transparency of what happens within that government. So revising the freedom of information laws, fixing the incentives, and for the population to be. And that is the only way from within, quote unquote, that a government will improve and where we will be able to regain the freedoms that we value, if we value them as a society.
Because which I think is excellent. It's very fair to point that conditional out, if we value them.
And so those are the things that I would do from within. But I look at the cypherpunk. And the cypherpunks created Bitcoin. They were real disruptors. They didn't disrupt the TradFi, the traditional finance from within. They disrupted it by creating something. And I think that is a key to effecting change in our society. It's not to try and work from within. Working from within may achieve some ends or goals or objectives,
but really,
we will ultimately create real change by creating something better that completely negates the old system. And this is something that is possible for a government. I wrote a fairly large paper about a decentralized regulatory framework.
Yes, I'll be sure to link to that.
It's based on game theory. It's based on leveraging the self-interest of the regulated entity in order to create incentive to remain within certain regulatory requirements. That's also possible for government. We don't need to have a top-down stick, gun to your face, boot on the head approach to regulation and supervision and governance in general. We are at a point where we have the technology, we have the ability to create tools and a new governance system will create a government that is completely transparent. If you look at 240 years ago, when the US Revolution happened, the Constitution created this amazing framework that worked at the time, united a population that had similar values, similar desires, and it created a foundation that enshrined those values and those desires. And because you didn't have telephones, you had to communicate through couriers, it was very localized. It didn't make sense to have everything done in Washington because it would take weeks or months to get there. And as the technology for communication improved, so too did centralizing government functions. It doesn't make sense to have five people in every state doing a function when you can have 10 in Washington doing the work of hundreds. And so,
although in practice they get both. Now they get both. They get to have the employees at the state level and the Fed. But I take your point.
Cynicism. You're welcome to it.
Yeah, it is.
And so when by this change in communication, we've had a centralizing force, and we've also had a polarizing of society. I don't even know today if the U.S. citizenry, and I'm talking about the U.S. because I assume people will be watching this or from there. I don't even know that the U.S. society has a common ground set of foundational beliefs and values that can unite the entire country. When it comes to immigration,
that's a big question right now.
If you look at immigration, if you increase immigration, you satisfy 50% and anger the other 50. If you restrict immigration, vice versa. If you allow guns, you satisfy 50%. If you allow drugs, marijuana, you
decriminalize.
And you can't have, I mean, libertarians are all about localizing governance. However, think about it. If you have immigration policies or gun policies where one state allows guns and another state completely bans them, you need suddenly to have a frontier, a barrier between them, and you need to search all the vehicles going back and forth to make sure that guns are not going from one to the other. So you can't really localize. And it used to be something that the entire population, I assume, or a large part of it, agreed with. Citizens have the right to bear arms. Mm-hmm. And it worked. However, society's norms and values have changed, and there's a polarization of values and opinions. And so I don't even know now if there's a common ground, sufficient common ground, to reestablish some kind of federal government without alienating 50% of the population.
Yes. No, it's a great point. There is a political cartoon, I believe, from the New Yorker that I often post. And it was printed just after 9/11. Jonick is the fellow's last name. And Uncle Sam is at a table, and the person behind the table is getting ready to wrap a gift, presumably. And behind him is Stop Terrorism and Protect the Children. And the gift in question, from the perspective of Uncle Sam, is a corporate control of free speech or internet speech. And so the point being, how would you like this wrapped? And so to your point, I think that is where we are largely in the U.S. is everything is a poll. One of my prior guests, my first guest, John Robb, writes a lot about tribes and swarms, as he calls them, political swarms, the red swarm, the blue swarm. And so it is an excellent point that to arrive at consensus will be very difficult here. But let's take it here. Where, if anywhere, be it looking to your paper and your proposed approach, or otherwise, have you seen bright lights? Are there jurisdictions where you're seeing them move toward the kinds of transparency, the kinds of accountability that you see as being a viable option, again, other than just individuals exiting by way of Bitcoin or otherwise?
Well, the Financial Action Task Force global standards have to be implemented. I think it's 127 different jurisdictions. And so I may just point to one of the jurisdictions that isn't implementing those standards, but they're not places that you want to live. North Korea and whatnot.
No, I wouldn't take that trade.
On an anti-money laundering front, all jurisdictions are complying. You look at El Salvador. I was in a meeting with other Financial Action Task Force. It's actually part of a different portion. So I was sitting in on that particular meeting. It's called the Caribbean. They were actually lauding El Salvador for their efforts to prevent anti-money laundering and financing of terrorism and increasing transparency, which basically means gathering more information and holding it, the government. So El Salvador is complying.
Their digital asset committee, I believe it is. I've done a bit of work with a couple of entities there, is complying harder, to put it one way.
There was one shining light that I really loved, and few people know about it, and that's Taiwan. If you look at the Taiwanese minister of, I think it's innovation, it's an ex-hacker that got elected. And she really had some amazing ideas to make government more transparent. It was beautiful. I think there was opposition. However, that opposition would have been moot if the population had embraced and participated. And I don't think that her programs got the participation she was hoping for, and so the programs got let down.
You should really, really look.
Chang Tam, Teresa Tam, I forget the name.
Yeah, I'll get that in the show notes.
Now, if you look at what her ideas were, she had the idea of using an online polling platform called Polis, P-O-L-I-S, to put every single consequential decision and to create a communal type of discussion for policymaking. Beautiful, wonderful. I don't think it got the traction that it needed to move forward. And that's the biggest disappointment working from within a government. That's what I've seen, is that the population don't get involved. The government might want to do something, and I don't know in the case of Taiwan. I'll admit I don't live there. It's the one place I'll admit to not living. However, I don't know what the reasons were. The people didn't really participate. And that's a shame, because countries that are doing the right steps should be encouraged and lauded and applauded. And I see so very few. I certainly don't see any in Europe. I can't say that I see any in Central America or North America. And, you know, I'm not that familiar with African countries, but I assume they want global capital investment money. And so they're complying harder than anyone else. And so don't know that there are any lights out there, but I do know that by being involved in government, it's the only way to light that torch. People watching this, don't get up. Send freedom of information requests. Push back. Complain. Criticize. Question. Doubt their government, their elected representative, in an active fashion. If they can get away with catering to lobbyists, that torch isn't going to be lit. And really, the key to maintaining our freedoms is that participation. I'm seeing very, very little of it.
Well, I'm assuming you're wearing that hat for a reason. So I take your point, which is clearly there is no silver bullet. There is no magic pill. What I take away is that FATF is the playground bully who leads others to give the beat down anytime anyone gets out of line. And so the ability to escape that is minimal. But I think if I understand you correctly, that it is creating, forcing more transparency through Freedoms of Information Act and other means. It is citizenry participating and voicing and adding pressure.
Revising the Freedom of Information laws.
To enable that.
Odell, or if anybody wants to really make a change within government that will really open things up for more transparency, because transparency kills criminal activity, cockroaches love to hide from the light. So with more transparency, you fix everything. You really fix everything. And those freedom of information laws are antiquated, and they haven't been looked at. And very few people, first of all, send freedom of information requests. It's free. You can. If you want to see where your congressman was last month, you can get their calendar. Every single email I write when I'm at work is FOIable. There's a huge amount of information that's obtainable by citizenry, but it requires time. You have to read it all. It's just that involvement that's necessary. But now with AI, we can have scanning of a whole database. So really, there are opportunities, but that legislative change, I really think the freedom of information request legislation around the world have to be updated. The fact they're there is great, But the government right now knows so much more about us, and we know so little about it.
It's a great point. I'm reminded I'm not on Twitter X anymore, but I see, you know, I get a link now and then, and there's an individual who goes by Data Republican, lowercase r, as she says, I believe, who is a data scientist and is, I think, using open source intelligence, largely open source intelligence. I don't know that she's conducting FOIAs, but I believe, in my mind, is a great example, to your point, of applying modern tooling to being able to rebalance what would otherwise be overwhelming in the case of the data you would receive from a FOIA. And I will, I'll be sure. I know you're watching this, Odell, so here's a shout out to him. So, you know, might have thought that you were moving toward a place where you're doing what you can, but your expectations are low. I don't now believe that's the case. I'll get you to correct me. You know, so you're not gonna be in Madeira at Sovereign Engineering, walking away from your government job in the near future, or are you? So let's wrap up on these two points. What is your best case expectation of your work in your current role? And then for those of us concerned, I hope more and more, about maintaining our privacy, our autonomy, what are some of the most effective steps that we can take to protect ourselves, to have a bit more agency in light of everything we've discussed so far? So what is a great outcome for you, and what is a reasonable expectation and steps we can take as individuals, in your view?
If you take a candle and you bring it outside at daytime, that candle will have a very small amount of light. You won't notice the candle. If you take the candle in a dark room, that candle can shine. That's really my moral justification for the work that I'm doing. I've done presentations for ministries and departments within my government, and I see looks from people who aren't willing to speak out, but think the same way I do. When I make a reference to something, when I say a particular word that implies something based on freedom, privacy, and I see those looks, and those are the torches that I'm looking at lighting with my small little candle. It's very rewarding to hear someone else in my department echoes something that I've said multiple times. So that's for me. That's the work I'm trying to do. As far as you or anybody who's dissatisfied with their government, the easiest thing you can do, say your elected representative did something, purchased something, or took a certain action that you disagree with, send an FOI requesting all of the emails that pertain to that particular purchase or action. Say it's spending money for a new building or a new program, or vote that your elected representative took that you disagree with. Say, well, I want all of your emails over the last year with this keyword. It's going to scare the bejesus out of your civil servants, and not just from your elected representative. Ask it for all civil servants within a particular department, within all the government. It would scare the bejesus out of me if somebody FOI'd me. And I've seen this happen.
By knowing.
And it's something that civil servants forget. When they send an email and they get an email, that's public information. It's just not disclosed. And so few people ask for it. They don't know all the emails that they've written over the last year, what they've said, what they haven't said. So when you send that FOI, you might not get what you're looking for, but just the fact that you sent it, the department, everybody in the department and your representative will know you sent it. And even if they find a way not to send the information to you, you scared them. And believe me, it works. Next time somebody needs to take an action, write that email, sign that contract, go to a particular meeting, conference, they'll think twice about it because they know it can come back and bite them. Send freedom of information requests. It's free. It's easy. It's a form. It's an email.
Excellent. And I think it is, you know, I'm as guilty as anyone of perhaps assuming that the guidance would be use this VPN, transact in Bitcoin more. But I think it's an excellent takeaway, which is it is unavoidable that in order to push back and enact change, that to your point, we have to remind them, you know, of ways in which they can be held accountable. So I think that's excellent. And I am just as guilty and will take your advice to heart.
Just don't ask why me, okay?
Wouldn't know where to send it. So that's great. OpenState, thank you. I am grateful for your time, grateful for your contributions. I appreciate that what you're doing is not without risk, personal and otherwise. So thank you for that. And I will be sure that we get links to your Nostra profile, to the paper you referenced, anything else that you'd like to point people to that would be useful to learn more about your work or the tools or the techniques that you've talked about.
Send you a link to the Taiwanese minister that I referred to.
Terrific.
If people are interested in seeing what positive changes, if change could look like, she's a good example.
Yeah, a firefly is sometimes all we need. Fantastic. Thanks again, OpenState. All the best. Talk to you soon.
Cheers.
Cheers.